but my device has properties most extraordinary. My hands were shaking. I found the mint, the neem bark, laura flower, set them in the chamber. Skaggs was watching closely.
Am I watching sorcery, sir? Right before myself? Unsanctioned?
No. I shook under his examination. Tried to load the balanthest.
Jala took it away.
Here, Papa.
Yes. Good. Thank you, child.
I took a deep breath. You see, the balanthest destroys bramble. And not just a little. The balanthest reaches for a bramble's root and poisons it utterly. Place it within a yard or two of a heart root, and it will destroy more than a bramble crew can destroy in half a day.
The mayor leaned close.
You have proof of this?
Yes, of course. I'm sorry. I pulled a small clay pot, shrouded in burlap, out of my bag, and put on my leather gloves before unwrapping it.
Bramble, I explained.
They both sucked in their breath at the sight of the potted plant. I looked up at their consternation.
We use gloves.
You carry bramble into the city?
The mayor asked.
Deliberately?
I hesitated. Finally, I said, it was necessary. For the testing. The science of alchemy requires much trial and error.
Their faces were heavy with disapproval.
I lit my match and touched it to the glass bulb. Clamped it closed.
Hold your breath, Jala. I looked apologetically at the mayor.
The smoke is quite acrid.
The mayor and magister also sucked in their breaths. The balanthast shivered as its energy discharged. A ripple of death passed into the soil. The pot cracked as the bramble writhed and died.
Magic! Skax cried, lunging forward. What magic is this?
No, magister. Alchemy. Magic has never been able to affect bramble. It does not sap bramble's poison, nor kill its seeds, nor burn back its branches. This is something new.
Skax grabbed for the balanthast.
I must see this.
It's not magic. I yanked the balanthast back, afraid that in his hurry he would destroy it. It uses the natural properties of the neem, I said. A special species, loved by magisters, yes, but this is merely the application of nature's principles. We vaporize the neem with a few other ingredients, force it through the tube, and with the aid of sulfur and saltpeter and charcoal, we send its essence into the earth. Even a small application does wonders. The neem essence binds with the root of the bramble, kills it, as you see. Attracted like a fly to honey.
And what causes the neem to seek bramble?
I shrugged.
It's difficult to say. Perhaps some magical residue or aura from the plant?
I tried thousands of substances before the neem. Only the neem bark works so well.
The neem is attracted to magic, you think?
Well, I hedged.
It is certainly attracted to bramble. Oil and water never mix.
Neem and bramble seem the opposite. What causes the affinity? I could feel myself starting to sweat under their combined gazes, not liking how Skax was obsessed with magic. I hesitate to say that it's magic the neem essence finds so attractive.
You talk all around the root of the issue, Skax said. Worse than a priest of Asim.
Forgive me, I stammered. I don't want you to think that I've been unwary in my investigations.
He's worried we're about to send him off to the executioner,
the mayor said. I gave the man a sickly smile.
Quite. Bramble is unique. It has qualities that we may think of as magical. Its astonishing growth, its resilience, the way that magic seems to fertilize its flourishing. But who can say what unique aspect causes the neem's essence to bind with it? These questions are beyond me. I experiment, I record my results, and I experiment again. The alchemical response to neem is bramble death. What causes that reaction?
whether it is some magical residue that leaches from the bramble root and somehow makes it vulnerable to neem, or some other quality, I can't say. But it works. And works well. There is a plot of earth that I myself have cleared into the bramble wall. In the time it takes you to clap your hands 3 times, I cleared more land than this office occupies.
The mayor and magister both straightened at the news.
So quickly? The mayor asked. I nodded vigorously. Even today, it still shows no sign of regrowth. No seeds, you understand. Not a single one. With my device, you can arm the people and take back farmland. Push back the bramble wall. Save Caim.
Extraordinary, Skak said. Not just push the bramble back. Perhaps even reclaim the heart of the Empire. Return to Jundpara.
Exactly.
I couldn't help feeling relief as their expressions lost their skepticism. The mayor had begun to smile widely. He stood.
By the three faces of Mara, man, you've done something special.
He motioned for Jarl and me.
Come, the two of you must have a glass of wine. This discovery is worth celebrating.
He laughed and joked with us as he guided us to a room with great windows that looked out over the city. Caim jumbled down the hill below us. On the horizon, the sun was slowly sinking. Red sunlight filtered through the smoke and cook fires of Lesser Caim. A half-constructed floating bridge arched across the river like a leaping cat, held in place by great hemp ropes to keep it from sailing away as they worked to extend its skeleton.
This couldn't come at a better time, the mayor said. Look out there, alchemist. Lesser Caim grows every day, and not just from the refugees of Turris and Alakan. Others, too, smallholders who have been overwhelmed by the bramble, and they bring their magics with them. Before they came, we were nearly in balance. We could still cut back enough bramble to offset the bits of magic use. Even the bridge would have been acceptable. But the Alakanas are profligate with their magic, and now the bramble comes hard upon us. Their habits are crushing us. Everyone has some little magic that he or she believes is justified, and then when a bit of bramble roots in a neighbor's roof beams, who can say who caused it?
He turned to me.
You know they call me the Jolly Mayor over there. Make fun of me for my scar and my poor humor. He scowled. Of course I'm in poor humor. We fight bramble every day, and every day it defeats us. If this keeps on, we'll be run out of here in 3/6 of years.
I startled at his words. Surely it's not that bad. The mayor raised his caterpillar brows.
Oh, yes. He nodded at Jala. Your girl will be part of a river of refugees, twice the size of the one we took in from Malakan.
He turned again to look west.
And where will they go then? Mpais? Lowe's? Turris is gone to raiders.
He scowled.
Lesser Caim is just as vulnerable. We barely fought off the raiders' last attack. Without the bridge, I cannot have a hope of defending that side of the river. And so we spend magic where we would prefer not to, and add to the problem. We are caught in Halzak's prison for certain.
His steward arrived with wine and goblets. I looked at the stemmed glasses with curiosity, wondering if I myself had long ago blown their shapes, but then recognized the distinctive mark of Sara Solso. She had improved since I used to compete with her. Another reminder of how long I had been at my project. The steward paused on the verge of uncorking the wine bottle.
Are you certain about this, Excellency?
He asked. The mayor laughed and pointed at me.
This man comes to us with salvation, and you worry about an older vintage?
The steward looked doubtful, but he uncorked the bottle anyway. A joyful scent filled the room. The mayor looked at me.
eyes twinkling.
"You recognize it?" he asked. "The happy bouquet of history."
I was drawn to the scent like a child to syrup crackers. Astonished and intoxicated, wide-eyed. What is it?
Wine from the hillsides of Mount Sena, the summer vineyards of the old empire, Magister Skak said. A rare thing, now that those hillsides are covered with bramble. Perhaps a score of bottles still exist, of which our jolly mare possesses now two.
Don't call me that,
Skak bowed. The name suits you today, Excellency.
The mayor smiled.
For once.
The steward poured the wine into the glass bulbs.
Currant and cinnamon and joy.
Magister Skak was watching me.
You're about to taste one of the finest pleasures of the Empire. Served at spring planting, for harvest, and for flowering age ceremonies. The richest merchants had fountains of it in their floating castles, if you can credit such a thing. Magic, make no mistake. The vintner's genius bound with the magister's craft.
He caught Giala watching, her eyes shining at the scent.
Come, girl, taste our lost history.
He poured a splash into a glass.
Not too much. You're too small to do more than taste, but I promise you, you will not forget this thing.
The mayor held up his glass, ruby and black in the setting sun.
A toast, then, gentlemen, to our future refound.
We drank, and the blood of the old empire coursed through our veins and made us giddy. We examined my instrument again, with the magister and the mayor making exclamations at the workmanship, at my methods for joining glass to copper, of metallurgy that had yielded a combustion chamber that would not crack with the power of the flames released. We talked of the difficulties of making more Balanthasts, and speculated how many miles we might clear of the surrounding countryside.
It takes a great deal of trouble to make one,
Skak observed.
Oh, yes, I said fondly, patting the venting tubes that ran along its outer surface and collected the gases of the burning neem. How many do you think you can make?
At first, I shrugged.
Perhaps it will take me a month to make another.
The mayor and Skak both showed their consternation, and I rushed on. But I can train other metal workers, other glassblowers. I need not do every piece of work. With others working to my specifications. With a larger workshop, many more could be made.
We could train the crafters who make the new arquebus, Skak said. Their work is obviously pointless. A weapon that can only be fired once and is so fussy. But this...
The mayor was nodding.
You're right. This is worth our effort. Those silly weapons are nothing to this.
Skak took another sip of his wine, running his hand over the Balanthast. A slow caress.
The potential here is astonishing.
He looked up at me, inquiring.
I think I would like to test it for a little while. See what it does.
Magister? Skak patted me on the back.
Don't worry. We'll be very careful with it. But I must examine it a while. Ensure that it truly uses no magic that will come back to haunt us.
He looked at me significantly.
Too many solutions to bramble have simply sought to use magic in some glancing way. To build a fire, for example, and then, when the bramble is burned, it turns out that so much magic was used in the making of the fire that the bramble returns twice as strong.
But the Balanthast doesn't use magic. I protested.
Skak looked at me. You are a magister to know this, then. In some cases, a man will think he is not using magical principles because he is ignorant. You yourself acknowledge that something unique is afoot with this device.
He picked up the Balanthast.
It's just for a little while, alchemist. Just to be sure.
The mayor was watching me closely.
Don't worry, alchemist. We will not slight your due reward. But for us, the stakes are very high. If we invest our office in something which brings the doom of Takaz instead of the salvation of Mara, I'm sure you understand.
I racked my mind, trying to find a reason to deny them, but my voice failed me. And at that moment, Giala started to cough again. I glanced over at her, worried. It had the deep sound of cutting knives.
"Go on," he said. "See to your daughter's health. She is obviously tired. We will send for you quite soon."
Jella's coughing worsened. The two most powerful men in the city looked down at her.
"Poor thing," the mayor murmured. "She seems to have the wasting cough."
I rushed to contradict.
"No, it's something else. The cold is all. It starts the cough and makes it difficult to stop."
Skax carried the Balanfest away.
"Go then. Take your daughter home and warm her. We will send for you soon."
All the way home, Jala coughed. Deep, racking seizures that folded her small body in half. By the time we arrived at our doorstep, her coughing was incessant. Keela took one look at Jala and glared at me with astonishing anger.
"The poor girl's exhausted. What took you so long?"
I shook my head.
"They liked the device. And then they wanted to talk. And then to toast. And then to talk some more."
"And you couldn't bring the poor girl back?"
"What was I supposed to do?" I asked. "Thank you so much, Mayor and Magister. I must leave, and no, the lost wines of Jundpura are of no interest to me. Name a price, and I will sell you the plans for my Balanthast. Good day."
Jala's coughing worsened. Keela shot me a dark look and ushered her down the hall. "Come into the workshop, child. I've already lit the fire." I watched the two of them go, feeling helpless and frustrated. What should have been a triumph had become something else. I didn't like the way Skax behaved at the end. Everything he said had been perfectly reasonable, and yet his manner somehow disturbed me, and the way the mayor spoke. All his words were correct, more than correct, and yet they filled me with unease. I made my way up the stairs to my rooms, empty now, except for piles of blankets and a chest of my clothes. Was I turning paranoid, into some sort of madman who looked beneath everyone's meaning to some darker intention? I had known a woman once, when I was younger, who had gone mad like that. A glassblower who made wondrous jewel pendants that glittered with their own inner fire, seeming to burn from within. A genius with light. And yet, there was something in her head that made her suspicious. She had suspected her husband, and then her children, of plotting against her, and had finally thrown herself in the river, escaping demons from the 333 halls that only she could see. Was I now filled with the same suspicions? Was I going down her path? The mayor and magister had both spoken with fair words. I unbuttoned my vest, astounded at how threadbare it had become. The red and blue stitching was old and out of mode. How broken it was. As was everything, except the Balanthast. It, at least, had gleamed. I had put so much hope into this idea. I'd spent so many years. A knock sounded on my door.
"Yes?"
Keela leaned in. "It's Jala. Her coughing won't stop. She needs you."
"Yes, of course. I'll come soon."
Keela hesitated. "Now, I think. It's very bad. There is blood. If you don't use your spell soon, she will be broken." I stopped in the act of fixing my buttons. A thrill of fear coursed through me.
"You know?"
Keela gave me a tight smile. "I've lived with you too long not to guess." She motioned me out. "Don't worry about your fancy clothes. Your daughter doesn't care how you dress." She hurried me down the stairs and into the workroom. We found Jala beside the fire, curled on the flagstones, racked by coughing. Her body contorted, as another spasm took her. Blood pooled on the floor, red as roses, brighter than rubies.
"Papa," she whispered.
I turned to find Pila standing beside me, with the spellbook of Magister Arun in her hands.
"You know all my secrets?" I asked.
Pila looked at me sadly. "Only the ones that matter." She handed me the rest of my spell ingredients, and ran to close the shutters so no sign of our magic would be visible, reportable to the outside world. I took the ingredients, and mixed them, and placed the paste on Jala's brow, bared her bony chest. Her breathing was like a bellows, labored and loud, rich with blood and the sound of crackling leaves. My hands shook as I finished the preparations, and took up Magister Arun's hand. I spoke the words, and magic flowed from me and into my child. Slowly her breathing eased. Her face lost its fevered glare. Her eyes became her own again, and the rattle and scrape of her breath smoothed as the bloody rents closed themselves. Gone. As quickly and brutally as it had come, it was gone, leaving nothing but the sulphur stink of magic in the room. Pila was staring at me, astonished.
"I knew," she whispered, "but I had not seen."
I blotted Jala's brow. "I'm sorry to have involved you." Jala's breathing continued to ease. Pila knelt beside me, watching over my daughter. Jala was resting now, exhausted from what her body had used up in its healing.
"You mustn't be caught, Papa,"
Jala whispered. "It won't be much longer," I told her. "In no time at all, we'll be using magic just like the ancients, and we won't have to hide a thing."
"Will we have a floating castle?"
I smiled gently. "I don't see why not. First we'll push back the bramble. Then we'll have a floating castle, and maybe one day we'll even grow vines on the slopes of Mount Sena." I tousled her hair. "But now I want you to rest and sleep, and let the magic do its work." Jala looked up at me with her mother's dark eyes.
"Can I dream of cloud castles?"
"Only if you sleep," I said. Jala closed her eyes, and the last tension flowed from her little body. To Pila, I said, "Open the windows, but just a little. Let the magic out slowly so no one has a chance to smell and suspect. If you are caught here, you will face the executioner's great axe with me." Pila went and opened one of the windows and began to air the room, while I covered Jala with blankets. We met again, at the far side of the workshop. At one time, I had had chairs in this room, for talk and for thought, but those were long gone. We sat on the floor together. "And now you are part of my little conspiracy," I said sadly. Pila smiled gently. "I guessed a long time ago. She clearly has the wasting cough, but she never wastes. Most children, by this time, they are dead, and yet Jala runs through the streets and comes home without a cough for weeks at a time, at least before she fell into bramble. The cough seemed to stay at bay unnaturally." "Why did you not call the guards?" I asked. "There is a fine reward for people like me. You could have lived well by selling your knowledge of my foolishness."
"You don't use this magic selfishly."
"Still, it curses the city. The mayor is right about that much. The help I visit upon Jala means that hurt is visited upon Chaim. Some neighbor of ours may find a bit of bramble growing in his flagstones. A potato woman in the field will dig up a new bramble root, attracted by my healing spells. The bramble wall marches ever closer, and cares not at all what intentions I have when I use magic. It only cares that there is magic to feed upon." I stood stiffly, and went to squat by the fireplace. Rolled a log so that it crackled and sent up sparks. Pila watched me. I could feel her eyes on me. I glanced back at her. "I help my child, and curse my neighbor. Simple truth."
"And many of your neighbors do the same," Pila said.
"Simple truth. Now come and sit. I rejoined her, and we both watched the fire and my sleeping daughter. "I'm afraid I cannot save her," I finally said. "It will take great magic to make the cough go away entirely. Her death is written in the dome of the Hall of Judgment, and I fear I cannot save her without great magic. Magic such as someone like Skax wields. And he will not wield it for the sake of one little girl."
"And so you labor on the Balanthast?"
I shrugged. "If I can stop the bramble, then there's no reason not to use the great magics again. We can all be saved." I stared at the flames. Firewood had grown expensive since brambles started sprouting in the nearby forest. I grimaced. "We're caught in Halzak's prison. Every move we make closes the walls down upon us."
"But the Balanthast works," Pila reminded me. "You have found a solution."
I looked over at her. "I don't trust them."
"The mayor?"
"Or the magister. And now they have my Balanthast. Another Halzakian box. I don't trust them, but they are the only ones who can save us." Pila touched my shoulder. "I have watched you for more than 15 years. You will discover a way." I sighed. "When I add up the years, I feel sick. I was certain that I would have the Balanthast perfected within a year or two. Within 5. Within 10 for certain. In time to save Murali." I looked over at my sleeping daughter. "And now I can't help wondering if I'm too late to save even Jala."
Pila smiled. "This time, I think you will succeed. I have never seen something like the Balanthast. No one has. You have worked a miracle. What's one more to save Jala?"
She pushed her dark hair back, looking at me with her deep brown eyes. I started to answer, but lost my voice, struck suddenly by her proximity. "Pila." With my work, I had never had time or moment to really look at her, staring into her eyes, seeing the slight smile on her lips. I felt as if I was surfacing from some deep pool, suddenly breathing, seeing Pila for the first time, perhaps even seeing the world for the first time. How long had I been gone? How long had I simply not paid attention to my growing daughter? Or to Pila's care, in the firelight of the workshop. Pila was beautiful. "Why did you stay?" I asked. "You could have gone on to other households. Could have made a family of your own. I pay you less than when you did little other than washing and cleaning, and now you run the household entire. Why not move on?" "I wouldn't begrudge it. Other households would welcome you. I would recommend you."
"You want to be rid of me just as you reach success?" Pila asked.
"No." I stumbled on my own words. "I don't mean to say..." I fumbled. "I mean, others all pay more." She snorted. "A great deal more, considering that I haven't taken pay in over a year." I looked at her, puzzled. "What do you mean?"
She gave me a sad smile. "It was a necessary economy, if we were to keep eating."
"Then why on earth didn't you leave?"
"You wished me to leave?"
"No."
All my words seemed to be wrong. "I'm in your debt. I owe you the moon. But you starve here. You can't think that I do not appreciate it. It's just that you make no sense." "You poor fool," Pila said. "You truly can't see farther than the bell of your Balanthast."
She leaned close, and her lips brushed mine. When she straightened, her dark eyes were deep with promise and knowledge.
"I chose my place long ago," she said. "I watched you with Murali, when she was well, and when she fell ill. And I have watched you with Jala. I would never leave one like you, one who never abandons others, even when it would be easy. You... I know all my secrets," I whispered, "all the ones that matter."
5.
The next day, the mayor again invited me to his great house on the hill to demonstrate the mechanics of the Ballenthurst. Pila helped me with my finest once more, but now she leaned close, smiling as she did, our cheeks almost brushing. My mustaches fairly quivered at the proximity of this woman, who had suddenly come into view. It was as if I had been peering through clouded glass, but now had finally polished a clear lens. Our fingers met on the buttons of my vest, and we laughed together, giddy with recognition, and Jala watched us both, smiling a secret child smile, the one that always touched her face when she thought she held some furtive bit of knowledge, but which showed as clearly on her expression as the fabled rocket blossoms of Jandpra showed against the stars. At the door, I hugged Jala goodbye, then turned to Pila. I took a step toward her, then stopped, embarrassed at my forwardness, caught between past lives and new circumstance. Pila smiled at my uncertainty, then laughed and came to me, shaking her head. We embraced, awkwardly, a new ritual, an acknowledgement that everything was different between us, and that new customs would right themselves over old habits. I held Pila close and felt years falling away from me. And then Jala crashed into us, hugging us both together, laughing and squeezing in between. Family. Finally family again. After too long without, the three faces of Mara, all of us a little more whole and grateful. I think she likes us this way, Pila murmured, and never leave me. Never. I left that empty house feeling more full of life than I had in years, silly and full of laughter all at once, thinking of weddings, of Pila as a bride, a gift I had never hoped to find again, the weight of loneliness lifted from me. Even the bramble-cutting crews didn't depress me, men and women hacking bits of it from between the cobbles, sweeping the city to make sure that vines didn't encroach. I smiled at them instead. With the Ballenthurst, people would at last be safe, could at last live their lives as they saw fit. In ancient Jandpra, magisters imbued carpets with magic so that they could speed from place to place, arrowing across the skies. Great wide carpets, as big as a room, with silver tea services and glass smoking vessels all set out for their friends, crossing the empire in the blink of an eye, flying back and forth from their floating castles and their estates in the cool north to their seasides in the gentle south. And children did not sicken and die, and there was no wasting cough. All things were possible, except that magic made bramble, and bramble dragged flying carpets from the sky. But now I had the solution, and I had Pila's love, and I would have Jala forever, or for at least as long as any parent can hope for a child. Not cursed at all, blessed. Out on the Sulang River, work was proceeding on the floating bridge. I couldn't help imagining what it would be like to have not just the one, but perhaps even three floating bridges. We could heat our homes in the winter with green magic flames. We could speed across the land. We could reclaim Jandpra. I laughed in the sharp spring air. Anything was possible. As I entered the mayor's house, the steward greeted me with quick recognition, which put me more at ease. My fears of the night before had been erased by sleep and Pila's influence and the warming spring sunshine. The steward ushered me into the audience gallery. I was surprised to find a number of notables also there, assembled in gold and finery, magistrates of the courts, clove merchants and diamond traders, generals and old nobility who traced their lineages back to Jandpra. Even the three ancient magisters of fallen Alakan. More people peered out from under the columned arches surrounding the gallery's marble and basalt flagstones. Much of Kaim's high and influential society, all gathered together. I stopped, surprised. What's this?
Magister Skax strode toward me, smiling a greeting.
We thought there should be a demonstration.
He guided me over to a draped object in the center of the hall. From its shape, I guessed it was my Balanthast.
Is that my instrument? I asked, concerned. The mayor joined us. Of course it is. Don't be nervous, alchemist. It's a delicate device.
The mayor nodded seriously.
And we have treated it with utmost respect.
Skats patted me on the back, trying to reassure me.
These people all around us are the ones whose support we need, if we are to affect your new Balanthast workshop. We must raise taxes for the initial construction, and...
He paused delicately.
Some of the old nobility may be interested in patronage, in return for ancient bramble lands reclaimed. I assure you, this is a very good thing. It's easier to gain support when people whiff profit than if they simply feel they are being taxed to no purpose.
He motioned me to the Balanthast.
Please, do not be nervous. All will be well. This is an opportunity for us all.
A servant brought in a huge pot containing a cutting of bramble more than 7 feet tall. The thing seemed to fairly quiver in its pot, hunting malevolently for a new place to stretch its roots. They must have planted it the night before, immediately after I left, for it to have grown so large. Multiple branches sprouted from it, like great, hairy tentacles. The assembled dignitaries sucked in their breath at the sight of humanity's greatest enemy sitting in the center of the gallery. In the light of day, with its hairy tendrils and milkweed-like pods dangling, it spoke of eldritch menace. Even the pot was frightening, carved with the faces of Takaz, the demon king, his serpent heads making offers of escape that would never be honored. The mayor held up his hands to the assembled.
Fear not. This is but a demonstration. Necessary for you to grasp the significance of the alchemist's achievement.
He waved a hand at the servants, and they lifted the drapery from my instrument.
Behold, the mayor said to the throng, the Balanthast.
The man had the gift for showmanship. I had to grant him that. The instrument had been polished, and now with sunlight pouring down from the upper galleries, it fairly blazed. Its glass chambers refracted the light, sending off rainbows. The copper bell mouths of its vents and the belly of its combustion chamber reflected the people in strange and distorted glory. The crowd gasped in amazement.
Has it been tampered with? I asked. Of course not,
Skax said. Just polished. That's all. I examined the workings of the thing, but took nothing apart. He paused, concerned.
Is it damaged?
No. But still I studied it. And did it satisfy you? That it does not use magic? That it is not some device of the Magister's pressed into new form?
Skax almost grinned at that. I apologize most profusely for my suspicions, alchemist. It seems to function entirely according to natural properties. A feat, truly. History can only bow to your singular genius.
He nodded at the assembled people.
And now, will you demonstrate for our esteemed visitors?
As I began assembling the ingredients, a general in the audience asked,
What is this instrument of yours, Skax? Salvation, warlord.
A fat merchant, out of the diamond quarter, with thick mustaches from his many children, called,
And what is the use of it?
The mayor smiled.
If we told you, it would spoil the astonishing surprise. You must see it as the Magister and I first did, without preface or preamble.
I armed the Balanthast, but then had to have the servants help me drag it over until it stood beside the huge bramble pot. Under the assembled gaze, it seemed to take forever to scrape the tripod over the flagstones.
Despite my faith in my device, my heart was pounding. I pulled on a leather glove and pinched out a bit of the potted soil, added it to the firing chamber, plunged the delivery nozzles into the dirt. At last, I lit the match. For a moment we all watched, silent. The collected ingredients burned, and then were sucked into the combustion chamber. A pause. I held my breath, thinking that Skax and the mayor had somehow broken the Balanthast in their ignorance. Then the Balanthast shook, and the snake faces of the Demon King burst wide, spilling soil as the pot shattered. The bramble toppled and hit the marble. The crowd gasped. Yellow smoke issued from the bramble's limbs. It writhed, smoking, twisting, boiling. Sap squealed and frothed as it effervesced, a dying howl from our ancient menace. People covered their ears as the bramble thrashed. More smoke issued from its vines.
Within a minute, the bramble lay still, leaving ash and tiny blackened threads floating in the sunlight.
Yellow smoke billowed slowly over the assemblage, sending people coughing and wheezing. But as the clouds dispersed, a great murmuring rose at the sight of the scorched bramble corpse.
"Inspect it," Skax cried. "Come to see. You must see this to believe."
Not many cared to come close, but the general did. Unafraid, he approached and knelt. He stared, thunderstruck.
"There are no seeds."
His wide-eyed gaze fell upon me.
"There should be seeds."
His words carried through the crowds. No seeds. No seeds. The lightning strike of miracle. The mayor laughed. Servants arrived with goblets of wine for celebration. Skax clapped me on the back, and the men and women of the great merchant houses came to stare at the cleansed soil before them. And then Skax called out again,
"One further demonstration."
The crowd clapped and stamped their feet. Again I primed the Balanthast, eager to show off the wonder of our salvation. I looked around for another pot of bramble, but none was in evidence. "How will I demonstrate?" I asked.
"It doesn't matter," Skax said. "Let it ignite free."
I hesitated. The mayor said,
"Don't be shy of a bit of showmanship. Let them see the glory."
"But it can't simply be fired. It must have something to attach to, some bit of earth at least." "Here." Skax took something from his sleeve.
"I have something else you might try this on."
He said something under his breath, and suddenly I smelled magic. The scent was different from the healing magic I had cast upon Jiala the night before. This was something special, bright as bluebells in the summer sun, sticky as honey. He pressed a folded bit of parchment into my palm.
"Put this in your Balanthast chamber," Skax said. "It should burn well."
The whiff of bluebell honey magic clung to the paper. I didn't want to. Didn't know what he was up to. But the mayor was nodding, and I was surrounded by the assembled people, all those great names and powerful houses watching, and the mayor motioned me to continue.
"Go on, alchemist. Show us your genius. The crowd loves you. Let us see this thing fire-free."
And, to my lasting regret, I did. I braced the delivery nozzles so they poked into the air, and lit my match. The spelled parchment and the neem and all the assembled ingredients disappeared into the belly of the Balanthast, and it roared. Blue flame erupted from the nozzles, a long streak of sparkling fire. Thick yellow smoke issued with it, and something else, the sticky breath of the magic-laced parchment Skats had given me. Flower brightness volatilized in the belly of the Balanthast, and now released as smoke. Beside me, Skax's body began to glow an unearthly aura of blue, sharp and defined, but not just him, the mayor as well. His steward also. I stared at my hands. Myself, even.
The fumes of the expended balanthast billowed through the room, and others began to glow as well. The general, the fat diamond merchant, his wife, more women in their skirts, men in their fine embroidered vests. But Skax's blue-limbed features were brightest of all.
"You are right," the mayor murmured. "Look at us all."
Everyone was staring at the many people who now glowed with spirit fire, gasping at the wonder of their unearthly beauty.
Skax smiled at me. "You are right, alchemist. Neem loves magic. It clings to its memory like a child to her mother's skirts." "What have you done?" I asked.
"Done?" Skax looked around, amused.
"Why, just added a bit of illumination to your neem essence. A way of seeing where your neem goes seeking. Your fine alchemy and my simple spellcraft make a lovely effect, don't you think?"
Boots thudded, and steel rang around the hall. Guards appeared from behind white columns and beneath the arches. Men in scaly armor, and the tramp of more boots behind them.
"Seize them!" Skax shouted. "All the ones who burn blue are guilty of magic's use. Every one! If they are not of the mayor's office, they are traitors!"
A babble of protest rose. Already the people who did not glow were shrinking from those that did. The general drew his sword.
"Treachery?" he asked. "This is why you bring us here?"
A few others drew steel with him.
The mayor said, "Sadly, warlord, even you are not immune to law. You have used magic when it is expressly forbidden. If you have some excuse, the magistrate will hear you."
He paused.
"Oh dear, it appears the magistrate is also guilty."
He waved to his guards.
"Take them all, then."
The general roared. He raised his sword and charged for the mayor. Guards piled atop him like wolves. Steel clashed. A man fell back. The general stumbled from within the tangle of steel. Blood streamed from half a dozen sword thrusts. For a moment, I thought he would reach us. But then he fell, sprawling on the marble. And yet, still he tried to reach the mayor, scrabbling like a beetle, leaving a maroon streak behind him. The mayor watched the general's struggle with distaste.
"On second thought, kill them all now. We know what they've been up to."
The guards howled, and the blue-glowing nobility shrank before them. Too few were armed. They scattered, running like sheep, scrambling about the gallery as guards hunted them down and silenced their begging. At last, there were no more screams. I stood in the midst of a massacre, clutching my balanthast. The mayor waved to the guards.
"Drag the bodies out, then go to seize their properties."
In a louder voice he announced,
"For those of you still standing, the holdings of the traitors will be sold at auction, as is custom. Your trustworthiness is proven, and you shall benefit."
He clapped Skax on the back.
"Well done, Magister. Inspired, even."
His eyes fell upon my own blue-glowing form.
"Well, this is a pity. It seems the Magister was right in all respects. He told me he smelled magic on you when we first met, and I didn't believe him. But here you are, glowing like a lamp."
I backed away, cradling the balanthast.
"You're the Demon King himself."
"Don't be absurd. Takaz would care not at all for stopping Bramble."
The guards were grabbing bodies and dragging them into piles, leaving blood smears behind. The mayor eyed the stains.
"Get someone in here to mop these tiles. Don't just leave this blood here."
He glanced around.
"Where's my steward disappeared to?"
Skax cleared his throat.
"I'm afraid he was caught up in the general slaughter."
"Ah," the mayor frowned.
"Inconvenient."
He returned his attention to me.
"Well then,
Let's have the device.
He held out his hands.
I would never give it here.
I stared at him, filled with horror at what he had done, what I had been complicit in. In a rush, I lifted the Balanthast over my head.
No!
Skax lunged forward. But it was too late. I threw down the Balanthast. Glass vacuum chambers shattered. Diamond fragments skittered across marble. Delicate copper and brass workings bent and snapped. I grabbed the largest part of the Balanthast and flung it from me, sending it sliding, breaking apart into even smaller parts, before coming to rest in the blood of its victims.
You fool.
Skax grabbed me. His hand closed on my throat and he forced me down. The blue glow about him intensified, magic flowing. My throat began to close, pinched tight by Skax's hate and power.
Join the rest of the traitors, he said.
My throat bound shut. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't even cry out. No air passed my lips. The man was powerful. He didn't even need an inked page to spell such evil. Darkness. And then, abruptly, sunlight. I could breathe. I lay on the flagstones and sucked air through my suddenly unbound throat. Magister Skax knelt over me. His hand lay upon my chest, resting gently, and yet, at the same time, I could feel each of his five fingers beneath my ribs, gripping my heart. I batted weakly at his hand, trying to push him away. Skax's fingers tightened, constraining the beat of my blood. I gave up. I realized that the mayor was standing over us both, watching.
The mayor points out that you are much too talented to waste, Skax said.
Again he squeezed my heart.
I do hope this faith proves true.
Abruptly, his grip relaxed. He straightened and waved for the guards.
Take our friend to the dungeon until we have a suitable workshop for him.
His eyes went to the broken Balanthast.
He has many hours of labor ahead.
I found my voice, croaked out words.
No, not this bloodbath. I won't be a part of it.
Skax shrugged. You already are. And of course you will.
6. Should I tell you that I fought, that I didn't break, that I resisted torture and blandishment and took no part in the purge that followed, that I had no hand in the blood that gushed down Chaim's alleys and poured into the Sulong? Should I tell you that I was noble, while others pandered, that I was not party to the terror? In truth, I refused once.
Then Skax brought Jala and Pila to visit. We all sat together in the chill of my cell, huddling under the water drip from stones, smelling the sweet damp rot of straw, and listening to the wet bellows of Jala's lungs, the fourth participant in our stilted conversation. Skax himself said nothing at all. He simply let us sit together. He brought wooden stools, and had a guard provide cups of mint tea, and at first I was relieved to see Jala and Pila unharmed. But then Jala's coughing started, and wouldn't stop, and blood speckled her lips, and she began to cry, and then I had to call the guard to take them away, and even though the man was fast in coming, it was still too slow. The last vision I had of Jala was Pila carrying her small form, her racking cough echoing against cold stones. And then, Skax came down to visit me again. He leaned against the wall, studying my dishevelment through the bars.
The cold of the dungeon disagrees with her lungs, he observed.
The repair of the first Balanthast was the price of Jala and Pila's well-being, but Skax and our jolly mare were not finished with me.
In Giala, they had the perfect lever. In return for the magic and healing that only Skax could provide, I created the tools and instruments they desired. My devices purchased life for myself and my family, and death for everyone else. Blood ran in the streets. It poured down Malvia Hill. It clotted in the cobble alleys of Lesser Chaim and flooded the fields beyond the city walls. Rumors in my prison said that the mayor's halls were redder than a sunset, that bodies burned in bramble piles, the fat of their cooking twinning with the yellow smoke of bramble to fill the skies with their funeral pyres. The executioner was so busy that on some days a second and even a third were summoned to take over the efforts of the axeman who had grown exhausted with his work. Some days they didn't even bother with the effort of a public spectacle. Skax had laughed at that.
When we couldn't find these furtive little spellcasters, we needed fear to keep the magic in check, he said. Now that we can hunt them down, it's better to let them practice for a little while and then seize everything.
As long as I furnished the tools of the hunt, I was not harmed. Skax and the mayor had so many uses for me. I was a prized hawk. Free enough within certain confines, the dynamic between us was as taut as the strings on a violin. Each of us would pluck at those strings, seeking gain, testing the other's boundaries, trying the tenor of the note, the question of its strain, the workings of my mind and its creations tugging against the value of Giala and Pila's well-being. And so we each tugged and pulled at that catgut strand. I was not a prisoner, precisely.
Morris Scholar, who worked all day and all night in a confined place, building better, more portable Balanfasts.
Constructing devices better tuned to sniffing at magic. Sometimes I myself forgot my situation. When the work went well, I was as focused as I had ever been in my workshop. I am ashamed to admit that there were even times when I reveled in the totality of focus that my cell provided. When there is nothing to do but work, a great deal of work can be done, and a great deal of time can pass.
Come now, I brought sweets. You like them? Pila urged. She sat outside the bars of my workshop, offering.
I sat, staring. I'm not hungry anymore.
I can see that. You're getting skinny.
I was skinny before. Pila watched me sadly.
Please. If you won't eat for yourself, then at least eat for me. For Giala.
Unwillingly, I stood and shuffled over to her.
You look unwell, she said.
I shrugged. Of late, I had been having nightmares.
Oftentimes, I would dream of a river of my victims, dreamed them pouring down the streets to where the executioner stood waiting, the hooded butcher chopping off heads as they flowed past, his axe swinging like a scythe, heads spinning in all directions. And I stood at the source of that river, casting each person into the flow, illuminating them in blue fire before tossing them into the current, sending them tumbling toward that final cataract of the axe. Pila stretched her hand through the bars and clasped my cold fingers. Her skin showed wrinkles, and her palm showed surprising dryness. I thought that maybe those hands had been soft, that she had been young once, but I could hardly remember. She clutched my hand. And against all the promises I had made myself, I collapsed against the bars, pressing her fingers to my cheek. That I hungered for her warmth was something I could barely stand. Magister Skax had offered us relief, as he called it, but he did so with such a leer that after the first time, I could do it no more, and spat in his face when he suggested the idea. Which enraged him so much that he barred Pila from visiting for nearly 6 months. Only when I threatened to cut my own throat with a bulb of glass did he finally relent and allow her visits again, if only through the bars.
I kissed Pila's fingers, starved for her kindness.